conference. But for now, we are in Matthew chapter 26. That's enough introduction. A couple weeks ago, we left off finishing Matthew chapter 25, and that was really a two-chapter section. You remember, just as a review, back in chapter 24, Jesus has his final, the end of chapter 23, he has his final run-in with the religious leaders. Chapter 24, he leaves the temple after saying, you know, I leave to your house desolate. Matthew 24 starts out, says Jesus went out, departed from the temple. His disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us when these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming in the end of the world? Because they figured, look, if these buildings go down, it has to be the end of the world. I'm sure while we were gone, some of you, I'm sure all of you, saw on the news the stuff that happened in Oklahoma with that the tornadoes. There's a Calvary Chapel in Oklahoma City, and I forwarded some of the guys this last night. One of the pastors sent around a picture. He said this was the view from one of the guys in my church's neighborhood. And, I mean, it was him standing on what looked like a deck, although I think it really was just the ground floor of his house now. But you could see for probably this him and another guy, and you could see for maybe a couple miles, and it looked like they were standing in a dump that was a couple miles wide. There wasn't a building to be seen anywhere as far as you could see, just completely demolished. And I'm sure if you had told them a week earlier that there isn't going to be a thing standing in your sight, trees, houses, nothing, they would have thought it must be a war, it must be a bomb going off. Well, when you imagine the temple, which had stones that were like 400 tons, and Jesus saying that, they thought it was the end of the world, and they said, tell us, when shall these things be? What'll be the sign of your coming in the end of the world? And he starts out by saying, don't be deceived. Many people will come in my name, saying them the Christ, and there'll be wars and rumors of wars, and these are the beginning of birth pangs. And then as he goes through, he talks about the abomination of desolation in verse 15. In verse 21, he talks about the great tribulation. Verse 27, he talks about his return. It'll be like lightning, like as it comes from the east to the west. Everybody will see it. Nobody will miss it. And verse 37, he talks about it'll be like the days of Noah, in that nobody's ready. They'll just be eating and drinking and marrying and pretending like everything is the same. And then in verse 44, he starts to talk about being ready, the wise and the foolish servants. Chapter 25, he tells the parable of the virgins, the wise and the foolish ones, those that are ready, that have their oil lamps full, the ones that aren't ready, figuring they can get ready and they miss it. Verse 14 of chapter 25, he tells the parable of the talents, those who take what they've been given and either invest it or work with it to bring a return for their Lord. And then verse 32 of chapter 25, he talks about his return and separating the sheep from the goats. And he ends chapter 25 by saying, and these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous unto life eternal. He finishes that. His teaching ministry is done at this point. There's no more public teaching. In fact, this was just disciples, and even then, it is the end of his teaching. And so we come to chapter 26, and it says, and it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days is the feast of Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Now, he said this over and over again, warning, I'm going to be crucified, I'm going to be crucified. And as he's been saying it, he's added more detail, I'm going to be betrayed, but he's been saying all along, I'm going to be crucified, but then I'm going to be raised again the third day. I'm going to be crucified, but I'm going to be coming back 3 days later. And he said it over and over again. I don't think they get it. They still seem shocked all the way through the process when it happens, and they're none of them waiting for him to return 3 days later, even though he said it over and over again. And I think, you know, sometimes we can be the same way. The Lord has warned us. We have warnings in the Scripture, things that we should expect, and yet we still act surprised when it happens. You know, one of the things I know always happens, it doesn't fail, whenever you go away or I go away to a retreat or some spiritual event and you're riding high on the mountaintop, you can be assured that either while you're gone or as soon as you come back, hell will break loose at your house. It just, without fail, you know. And I'm having this wonderful spiritual experience while my wife is in the pits of despair with my daughter. I mean, that happens. And then as I'm coming back, she and my daughter, for those of you who don't know my family that well, I have four children, and my youngest is 12. And she has some significant medical issues. She doesn't walk. She doesn't talk. She has to be fed every 2 hours through a feeding tube. We move her around. She has a seizure disorder. There's other things with her. Well, when they're one and that happens, it's one thing. When they're 12, it's quite another. When you're moving a baby, it's one thing. When you're carrying my daughter, and I weighed her when I got home because she's just got 78 pounds. You know? I can move her pretty easy. Well, no, I can't. She's heavy, but I can move her. My wife, no. And so she throws her back out, like, as I'm driving home. So she's, you know, the other kids are trying to help and all that stuff's going on. So you just know that's going to happen. And in this life, you know, we sometimes we're surprised. You know, and of course, as I'm going through this and I'm coming home and I get the call from my wife in bed saying I did something to my back. And of course, my daughter was going. The next morning, my wife is taking my daughter to Vermont because she's going to this writing class thing she's taking in at a college down there. So I'm coming home. She's leaving the next morning, except for she can't get out of bed. And so I'm thinking, you know why, Lord? Because I'm your pastor, right? I mean, why? I could see why this might happen to other people, but, you know, me? I mean, why me? I'm trying to do what you want. Why? And that's what thought goes through your head. Why? Why is this happening? And it's almost like I can just picture the Lord saying, duh, you know? Because I told you it's going to happen. He said it was going to happen. He said in John 16, these things I've spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. And he says in another place, look, the servant is above his master. I live the perfect life. And they crucified me. How would you really expect it to be? How wouldn't you expect to be mistreated? Wouldn't you expect to have difficult times? And sometimes, you know, there are some people who are trying to draw a following and they misrepresent the gospel and they try to tell you that being a Christian is all peaches and roses. And if you become a Christian, everything's just better. You know, you'll have joy, you'll have peace. You will have joy. You will have peace, but you don't escape the storms. It just means you have the opportunity to have joy and peace in the middle of the storms. Well, he's telling them, look, I'm going to be crucified. It's the Passover. The Passover is all about ultimately pointing to the crucifixion. I mean, it certainly was instituted thousands of years before this when they left Egypt under Moses, but ultimately it was pointing to what's going to come with him. Well, verse 3, then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people under the palace of the high priest who was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. The high priest was you inherited the role of high priest. It had to be a descendant of Aaron. That was how it worked. Except for when Rome had taken over, they found, because the high priest was the religious leader of the people, it was very advantageous for Rome to have somebody that they could control in that position. And Annas was the high priest. He recused himself and let his son-in-law Caiaphas take it over. Annas was the guy who ran the marketplaces that were at the temple, the money changers that Jesus had thrown over a couple times. It was his family that was running all that was ripping people off in the name of religion. It was much better for Annas to not be the high priest and therefore be separate from Rome enough, even though he certainly was in cahoots with them, but be separate enough so that the people, you know, wouldn't hate him and he could continue ripping them off. So Caiaphas is, but he still was pulling the strings. That's why he gets his son-in-law in there, Caiaphas. The high chief priests, the rulers, they gather together to figure out the best way to take Jesus and kill him, but they don't want to do it on the feast day. Now, the feast day is a holy day, holiday, right? Holy day. It's a religious celebration. Doesn't it seem a little strange that the religious leaders on one of the most holiest religious days are plotting to kill the Messiah sent by God? But we can't do it on that day. Not because it would be wrong. Doesn't matter. Only because we don't want people to hate us. Because, you know, we're slaves to public opinion. And if we do it on that day, when they're all expecting a savior, he might become this martyr and we get into trouble. So we need to find a way to do this quietly. The problem is you are in Jerusalem. And it's packed this time of year. You don't know, we don't know how many people, because the Jews, way back under David, David took a census. He decided to count the people, and he did it because he wanted to know how strong his army was. He wanted to know, you know, how rugged he is. And even his unspiritual military advisor said, look, you know, you're as strong as you need to be, David, but the strength of your army is not in how many people you have, it's in the Lord. So don't tempt the Lord by counting people to see how strong you are. And David did it anyway, and this great plague broke out, and the Lord punished the people and David for it. So ever since then, they refused to be numbered. They never wanted to make that mistake again. So we don't know how many Jews there were at this point. All we do know, they kept pretty good records, and around this time, Josephus tells us that the number of lambs that they slaughtered at Passover around this time was 250,000. And the Old Testament prescription was a lamb for up to 10 people. So there were at least probably 2.5 million Jews in Jerusalem at this time. A city that only had usually a few hundred thousand in there is now packed, a couple million people, swarming with people, so much so in certain times you couldn't even move around the Temple Mount. There's no cell phones to track. There's no predator drones. There's, you know, this is an enemy of the state. There's no satellite zooming in and watching you walking around. So they need to know. We don't know where Jesus is. It's he doesn't even live in the city. He's just staying from house to house. So they needed to find a way to get him. But the only time they're seeing him is in the temple, and they can't arrest him in the temple in front of everybody because it would cause a riot and all of that. So they're trying to figure out a way to arrest him privately without causing a scene and kill him. Now in verse 6, it says, when Jesus was in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, presumably formerly Simon the leper, Jesus wasn't in the habit of staying around people who were lepers without healing them. So if Simon has a house, he's not a leper anymore, because if he was still a leper, he'd be living in a leper colony outside of the city. So this is Simon who formerly was a leper. You know, there's a great study just to look at the people that hung around with Jesus. You have Simon, who used to be a leper and wasn't anymore. At this point, you've got Bartimaeus, who used to be blind and isn't anymore. We're going to see this is going to be Mary and her sister Martha and her brother Lazarus, who used to be dead and stank and doesn't anymore. Jesus' followers are a collection of used-to-bes, which is who we are. You know, one of the things I love about going to the pastor's conference in Calvary, for all of our failings, and we have many, one thing that they do tend to do in Calvary Chapel is use reclaimed junk for pastors. I mean, all the guys who, other than Chuck Smith, who seemed to be pretty decent from a young guy, all the guys who followed him were like ex-hippies. You know, Joe Foch was kind of overseeing the whole thing from Calvary, Philly. He used to be LSD dropping, coke snorting hippie living in the woods eating rice and beans. The worship leader was Rob Paoletti, who used to be a heroin addict. You had Damien Kyle speaking, who used to be another hippie, had hair down below his bum. You had all of these just used up, washed out people that the Lord reclaims and then does something with. And well, that's who's at this place. And in the midst of this, it says, there came unto him a woman having an alabaster box, a very precious ointment. She poured it out on his head as he sat at meat. But when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, to what purpose is this waste? For this ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor. Matthew doesn't tell us who this woman is. John, written much later, tells us who it was. And I almost think Matthew didn't say, because about the time Matthew's writing, persecution is starting to ramp up, and you name somebody who's still alive as being a worshiper follower of Jesus, you get him into trouble. He doesn't say. John, she's probably far dead by the time John writes his gospel. She tells us it's Mary. It's Mary and Martha's sister Mary, not Mary Magdalene, who had seven devils cast out of her, not the immoral woman who comes and cries over his feet. This is Mary and Martha. She shows up three times in the scripture, and it's interesting. She's pretty much always at the feet of Jesus. She's at the feet of Jesus in Luke chapter 10. You remember he's at their house, Mary and Martha. Martha's in the kitchen doing Martha things, but she's working. Mary had done some work, but now she was sitting and listening to Jesus, and Martha's ticked, saying, you need to tell Mary to get in the kitchen and help me out. And Jesus says to her, Mary, Martha has chosen the thing that's most important, which is to sit at my feet, and that's not going to be taken away from her. And we see her sitting at his feet. Later on, we see her showing up when her brother dies, the one that it says Jesus loved, and yet he dies and he's buried and he's in the ground 4 days, so he's stinking. And Jesus shows up, and when he shows up, Mary runs out to him and says, Lord, if you'd been here, if you'd only been here, you could have saved him. I know you could have saved him. And we see her again. The first time she's listening to him, the second time she's asking, she's making her request be known. Here this third time, she's at his feet again. And even though the disciples don't get it that he's going to be crucified in a couple days, I think Mary does. I think she knows what's going on, which is why she's doing this. He's going to say, she's doing this against my burial. The thing that she does, she's doing it because I'm going to be buried. Normally, in that culture, somebody dies, you get them in the ground quick because there's no embalming. And if you've ever experienced the joy of meat left out on a hot day, you know it smells, right? Quick, dead body, same thing. And so they would cover them with spices and everything to try to keep the smell down, wrap the body, and that same day get them in a tomb somewhere and seal it up so nobody would smell what comes next. Instead of waiting until he died, she's going to pour out very aromatic, very costly ointment on him. And I think this third time you can say for sure it's an act of worship. John tells us Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet. She wiped it with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. I mean, it's strong stuff. This stuff would be kept in a little flask that was like a one-use thing. Very expensive. In another gospel, it's going to tell us this could have been sold for around 300 pence, which was basically the salary of a laborer for a year. A year's wages. I don't know, what's a working person make? $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year. That's high for Maine. $20,000, $15,000 a year. Most ladies, this would be like their dowry for their wedding. Her brother, whom she loved, died. She didn't break it for him. Now Jesus is going to be buried, and she takes this thing that was probably reserved for a wedding, and she breaks it open. She pours it all over him. She dumps it on his head all the way down to his feet. She's taking her hair and she's wiping his feet. She's worshiping. I mean, the word worship literally means to kiss the feet. That's what it means. The worship at the conference I was at was transformational. Not because the music was great, although they were great musicians. Not because the singing was great, and it was. It was overwhelming. For me, part of it is, you know, I come here on a Sunday morning. How do I say this in a way that doesn't sound bad? I have to perform on some level, right? Because you guys are expecting. I'm leading things. Here I am. I have to come up and teach a Bible study and have all my points come together and end in the right time so you don't miss football or dinner or whatever it is you're going to do. And the worship has to go smoothly. The songs have to tie in. We have to do things in a way that you're expecting, and I have to make you laugh a little bit and make you think a little bit and all of that stuff. And so I have all those things. And then, you know, when I'm up here and I try to put myself in the back as much as possible, I turn off my mic so you don't hear me sing because I don't want you to leave before the Bible study. And I usually close my eyes. I don't see much of what's going on around, to be honest with you, because that wrecks it all the more, you know. No offense, but looking at you when I'm trying to worship God kind of wrecks it. So, which is why it's hard for you, I'm sure, because you got to look at me while you're trying to worship God. So, but to go down there and be part of that worship, I'm just a face in a crowd of 1,000 faces. I'm nobody special. In fact, I'm anything but anything special. And I can actually worship the Lord. Nobody's expecting me to do anything. And that's nice. You know, I see two elements that jump out to me about this woman worshiping the Lord here. One is it's extremely personal. When you are wiping someone's feet with your hair, you're personally engaged with them, okay? Feet in general, anybody touching your feet's pretty personal. As far as I'm thinking, I don't know how you do the pedicures. I don't know how you do the massages. Limited amount of people who touch my feet, okay? Namely me and maybe my wife. And that's only if she is very gentle, because I am very ticklish and I just don't like my feet touched. So very intimate. And the other thing it was very costly. Anybody can sing a song, repeat words, follow notes. That's not worship, that's singing a song. In fact, there was no song involved with this woman at all. Worship was her pouring out something very precious to her for the Lord. Engaging him personally, really showing her heart to him. That's what worship is. You know, I'll tell you, there was one point, it's easy for me because they're not here, okay? But as I said, I've been waiting for at least 2 years to get them both to this conference, only because I've only known Jeremy a couple years. Had I known him longer, I would have wanted him there. I've wanted Joel there longer. And they both said, you know, every year you come back and you talk about the worship there. And we're like, yeah, okay, that's nice. And then we were there this year. Now we understand. That's what they said. You just don't understand. I know I'm not doing it justice. But there was one point, and they usually take communion night, like the last night that we're there, they'll do an extended worship thing. And at different times, I mean, it eventually leads up to communion, but we'll sing a few songs. They'll do prayer. You know, is anybody hurting, sick, physically ill? Stand up. And then those people will do a song, and those people around here just pray for you. We don't need to know what it is, but let's just pray. And you see guys praying for each other. And one of the ones they do every year is, and of course, someone gets up, there's a guy in a wheelchair a couple rows ahead of me. And to be there, and then they do that, and I see Jeremy, who's two seats to the right of me, immediately get up and go and lay hands on this stranger and just start praying for him with some other guys. I'm like, okay, knowing him and where he's been, wow, okay. And then a couple things later, okay, what we're going to do next is prodigals. How many of you have prodigals, that you have children or people that you love that have gone wacko? Stand up. And of course, people, there's guys standing up all over the place, because just because you're in ministry doesn't mean your kids don't go nuts. In fact, a lot of times it guarantees they will. But then again, who is the prodigal dad? God. So if he can have prodigals, then I guess you can too. But he says, what I want is, if there are any of you who were prodigals and have come back, I want you to go pray for them. And then afterwards, when you're done praying, I want you to look at him and tell him, don't stop praying. Don't stop praying. And Joel, if you know Joel's story, jumps right up and goes and starts praying for some guy. And I was just weeping, and thanking the Lord because of what he can do. He can take messed up people like us, and he can turn us around, and he can make life where there was none, and he can make hope where there was none. And what else can you say but, wow, thank you, you know? Thank you, thank you. That's worship. And she's just saying, thank you, thank you. You made life where there was none. If this is her dad's house, Simon the leper, my dad was a leper. You cleaned him up. You gave him hope. My brother was dead. You brought him back. You gave him life. He stunk, and now he's alive. What else can I do but give you everything I have? And that's what our worship should be for the Lord. And something, you know, it's so easy for us to come in here and, you know, shine, Jesus, shine, unwrap the mint, you know, I mean, get ready. That's not worship. Worship is giving him your all, pouring out your life, offering him whatever you have, even if it doesn't feel like anything. That's what he wants. Well, when his disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, to what purpose is this waste? If you read John's account, John tells us it was Judas that started it. In John chapter 12, verse 4, then said one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him, why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence, a year's wages, and given to the poor? That sounds very, very noble. Shouldn't we be taking, look at how much money this is, it's like 20,000 bucks, why don't we give that to the poor? Of course, John tells us, he goes on to tell us a real motivation. This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and he had the bag. And he bare that was put there. He kept the money. Jesus had him run the finances. Now, he knew from the beginning who was going to betray him. And he let him work the finances. which is what I always told Josh Matthews when he was here. That's why I allowed you to oversee the finances, because no. Interesting thing is, Judas starts it and they all follow. The other disciples get caught up. Yeah, yeah, why don't we give this to the poor? What a waste. To what purpose is this waste? In John chapter 17, Judas is called the son of perdition. That word perdition, it's the same word here. Literally, son of waste. Because his life was a waste. Have to understand, John was there when Jesus calmed the waves. Judas was there when Jesus calmed the waves. Judas was there when Jesus healed the lepers. Judas was there when he fed the 5,000. Judas was sent out and given the ability to heal with the other guys. In a little bit, when Jesus is at the Last Supper and he says, hey, somebody here is going to betray me, and they're all saying, is it me, is it me? They're not saying, Judas. I mean, they don't know. They have no clue. In fact, they question themselves before they ever question Judas because he looks like the perfect follower. Jesus trusts him with the money. He's got to be. He's not the black cape guy you think of. He looks like everybody else. Jesus knows. He said all along someone's going to betray him. And he knew picking Judas that he was going to be the one. And when Jesus understood it, he said unto them, why trouble you the woman? For she has wrought good work upon me. He gets ugly. Leave her alone. You know, it's interesting how one guy murmuring and complaining could lead all the other ones down the same road. I like going away with those guys because, you know, I'm glad I used to live in Philadelphia. We were there for a couple days. I'm glad I don't anymore. I don't like the person I become on their roads. I become a mean person. You have to be. You know how in Lincoln, when you're on Main Street and someone steps off the curb and you stop and you wave them ahead? The waving that goes on in Philadelphia involves one finger and you don't stop, okay? You just don't. You become a different person. If you let somebody out ahead of you, you'd never get anywhere. You can't. So you have to become that mean, ugly person. You have to cut people off in traffic, avoid eye contact. You have to be that guy. I don't like being that guy. And it was nice to go down there with those other guys because they helped reminding me of, you know, they build me up. It's good to go out with brothers and sisters and to hang out with them, people who love the Lord, because they bring you, they help keep you on the straight and narrow. These guys, it takes one moment of somebody murmuring and complaining. And I think, you know, it's important. It says, in a paraphrase or the NIV version, 1 Corinthians 15, bad company corrupts good character. The people you hang with influence your speech, they influence your thoughts, they influence your likes, your dislikes, all of that. Good thing to think about. Jesus says, you have the poor always with you in verse 11. Me, you don't have always. Interestingly enough, the poor will always be with you. And how much have we spent trying to cure poverty in our country? A lot. And the poor are still with us. Have you noticed that? Doesn't matter. Poor will always be here. He says, for she, in that she has poured out this ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this, that this woman has done, be told of a memorial for me, of her. And still here we are 2,000 years later talking about this woman worshiping the Lord. Well, Judas at this point has been rebuked. You know he's in it for the money. Jesus is saying, I'm going to be crucified. Maybe we don't really believe it. Now this woman comes, dumps out 20, 30 grand on him in one pop, and he confirms this is for my burial. He's really going to die? And there's not even going to be any more money coming through this ministry that I can steal? What a waste. I might as well get the best I can out of this. So he goes in verse 14, he goes to the chief priests and he says to them, what will you give me and I'll deliver him unto you? And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. That's not a lot. 25, 30 bucks. It's not a lot. Matthew uses the word covenanted with him, literally waited out to him. It alludes very much to what Zechariah prophesied back in chapter 11 of Zechariah hundreds of years earlier. Zechariah said, and I said unto them, if you think good, give me my price, if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. That was his price. He traded in the Lord for 25, 30 bucks. You imagine? Well, what's your price? What is your price? Now look, we're not going to sell the Lord to be crucified. Although it does say, if you sin, when you willingly sin and you know and you've been forgiven, but you go willingly sin anyways, you crucify the Lord afresh. So on some level, when we go out and we do what we know is way against his will, anyways, we're selling him out. And it's amazing how cheaply we do that. What's your price? Pixels on a screen? A bottle? An herb? I don't know. You know, it's different for everybody. See, in verse 16, it says, and after he does that, from that time, he sought opportunity to betray him. He was looking for a chance to do it. The problem is, I think sometimes we look for a chance. We make a chance. Because, look, we all struggle with different things. Of course, all of us struggle with sin. There are various ways it manifests in our life. You know, some people, it's booze. They've always struggled with booze, and if they're around it at all, they know they're going to fail. Or for other people, it's porn or other, whatever it may be that is your thing that you struggle with. Do you make provision to stumble? You know, it says this in Romans chapter 11. It says, in that knowing the time, now is the high time to wake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believe. The night's far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, that's lusting, not in strife, fighting, and envying, but put you on the Lord Jesus Christ and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. I know people who don't have a computer at home, because they know where they struggle and they realize they can't have it. I know people who don't have a TV, don't have any type of, you know, feed into their TV because they know where their problems are, and they say, if that's going to cause me to stumble, I can't have it in my house. Certainly, I know a lot of people who struggle with booze who won't be anywhere near alcohol or drugs. I know people who put other people out of their lives because they know, not that I hate them, I love them, but if I'm near them, I will go into sin again. Are you making provision for something? Have you kept it around, kept it close, looking for an opportunity so you can go back? Well, run. Run from it. Now, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying to him, "Where will you that we prepare you to eat the Passover?" Interesting the way he responds. He said, "Go into the city to such a man and say unto him, the master says, my time is at hand, and I'll keep the Passover at your house with my disciples." Mark 14 tells us this. Jesus gives him more instruction. See, Judas, okay, I've taken the 30 pieces of silver. They want to arrest him out of the public eye. All I need to do is find out where he's going to be at what time. I can go tell them. They'll come when they'll arrest him. Jesus never gives him that. He is orchestrating everything. He is going to be crucified on the Passover. He is the Passover lamb. So no matter what happens that they try to scheme, they can't get away from doing it on that day because it was prophesied it's going to be on that day. So Judas is looking for a chance. I'll know where he'll be, a date and a time. So when it comes time, where are we going to have the Passover dinner? Judas is thinking, here's my chance. Let me just listen for the address. Jesus doesn't give him address. He picks two of the guys. He says, I want you to go into the city. When you walk into the city, you're going to see a guy carrying a thing of water. Follow him. When you follow him, go into the house where he goes, go to the master of the house and say, the master needs the room. He'll prepare it for you. He never gives him an address. He says, look for a guy doing menial labor. He should stand out to you. Doesn't matter that there's 2 or 3 million people in the city. You see a guy carrying water, which is normally what the women do. He'll stand out. It's not like you're going to see 500 men because men are lazy, okay? And so look for a working man. That should stand out to you and follow him. No, literally, I like this guy because here he is doing something that is beneath him, right? Carrying water, slave work, women's work. See a man doing women's work. He's not named. I like someone behind the scenes and serving. One of the people who spoke at the conference, the one that had the most impact on me, was a guy named K.P. Yohannan. Indian guy. He oversees gospel. He runs Gospel for Asia, which has tens of thousands of pastors in India out, you know, amazing thing. And he doesn't say it publicly, but he's Calvary Chapel. That's what he's part of us. There are, you know, tens of thousands of little Calvaries of little Indian guys running out on bicycles and starting churches all over India. And he was telling some of his story growing up. And he was one of like seven, youngest. And his mother got saved. Someone started a church in their area. She gets saved. And he says, I remember my mother every day getting up, praying for like 3 hours. 3 hours every single day. And he didn't know it, but one of the things she'd been praying for a few years, well, he goes, you know, the brothers all go into business and start to become successful. He goes to school, he's going to go into business, and then he kind of feels like the Lord wants him to be a missionary. And he comes home and tells his mom, Mom, you know, he gets out of school, I'm thinking that the Lord wants me to be a missionary. And she immediately says, do it, go. And he says, so much so that I'm thinking, you seem to want to get rid of me awful bad. You know, I wouldn't think you would be quite that anxious. And she says, you know, you don't understand. I prayed all along that the Lord would make one of my kids a missionary. And as your brothers and sisters got older, I figured they would be the ones, you know, because you're kind of a runt and scrawny and whatever else. And it didn't look like it was ever going to happen. He said, for the last 3 years, she'd fasted one day a week, every Friday, and prayed for three and a half years. And then he comes home 3.5 years later and is an answer to her prayer, you know. I think 3.5 years fasting and praying for anything. Imagine that. But you think about who is going to stand out in heaven, people who do things quietly. He says, you know, so he goes and he starts this gospel flavors and everything, but he's successful, although he's pretty much given away everything. But and his brothers are all successful, but their mom, still living back in India, he goes back there a couple years before she dies, and she's wearing this ratty old shawl. It had this big rip in the sleeve, and she'd sewn it up like with yarn. I mean, it was horrible looking. And he said, I went off on my mother, and I said, what are you doing? You're bringing shame on us as family. You know, he goes into the whole Indian, you put dung on our heads and you, you know, I mean, you're embarrassing us. Everybody will think that we don't love you, and we do. Why don't you buy a new shirt so that people don't think, you know, we hate you? And she says to him, you stupid boy, you don't know anything. She says to him. A couple years later, she dies. And he's back there, you know, going through the stuff with his brothers. And they were talking and they were wondering where their mom's money was, because he said, we never saw her spend anything. So we figured she had a bunch of money in the bank. She had to, because she never bought anything. She never spent on anything. I mean, she just, all those years and everything. And one of the brothers come out and said, I found this in her room, and it was a notebook that was under a pillow. And in it was page after page of handwritten names and amounts of missionaries and kids who were in Bible school, and the amount of money that she had, without telling anybody, for years and years and years. And she had taken everything. When she died, she had left her wedding ring, a necklace that her husband had given her, and her earrings. And she wrote a note to them saying, when I die, I want you to take my ring and my necklace and my earrings, and I want you to sell them and use the money so that people can know about my Jesus. I'm going to be in the back of the line. And this woman that nobody knows is going to be in the front. Not because she had this great ministry, but because she prayed and she fasted and she gave all she had silently for the Lord. Well, a couple more verses. The disciples did as Jesus had appointed them. The disciples did as, that verse alone, you could stay right there. Because that is the difference between a follower and a disciple. There were thousands of people following Jesus when he's doing miracles and he's saying interesting things and he's entertaining them and he's feeding them. But a disciple is different, because a disciple does as he says. You know, James, I like it in the New Living, James 1:22 says, don't just listen to God's word, you must do what it says, otherwise you're only fooling yourselves. Now, when evening was come, he sits down with the 12. They're at a triclinium. It's a big horseshoe shape. The Last Supper painting you've seen, theologically horrible. There was no chairs. They would have a low table. It would be shaped like a horseshoe, and they would recline next to it. They would sit, and they would eat. They would share a common bowl. In our culture, you don't double dip, right? You dipped, you bit, you dipped again. I mean, that's just wrong on so many levels, but you don't do that. You don't, because we know about germs and stuff. You were very particular about who you eat. That's why when Jesus would go to anybody's house, he'd go to the prostitutes, the tax collectors, all the sinners, and eat with them. The religious people would freak out, because when you ate bread with somebody, you were becoming one with them. You know, we go to a restaurant, the Cracker Barrel, actually, right? Joel and Jeremy, they've known each other a long time, if you don't know any of their stories, but they were, you know, rock star wannabes, and their band was touring all over the place. They were sleeping in a van. Jeremy's like, yeah, we slept in a van together. And so you were sleeping with men in a van. We gave him a hard time for most of the trip, actually, about that. But we sit down. Joel orders this bacon cheeseburger, some other stuff. Jeremy's sitting next to him, and they serve it open-faced, right? Open-faced, so there it is, and there's this cheese-covered bacon thing. Jeremy looks over at that, grabs the burger off the bun, takes a bite and says, you're going to eat that? And throws it back down on the thing. And he says, this is a long history, I guess, of them poking each other's food while they were on the road. I don't know. Joel's like, yeah, I am. And he seals up the rest of it and finishes eating it, you know? Thinking, I'm holding everything close at this point. I'm going to sit around the table from Jeremy because you ain't going to be touching my food. You know, who knows where you've been? But well, in that culture, you shared a common bowl. You'd break off a hunk of bread, you'd dip, you'd bite, you'd dip, you'd bite, and you were, you know. And they're at this table, and it's interesting because the way it would work is the first spot, the one that would get served first around the table, was the place of honor. Then there would be the host in the second spot, and then from there, next to the host, going around the table of the higher place, you know, the closer you are to the host, the more honored you are, and then all the way down to the low guy. We know from what it says in the Gospels that John was immediately to Jesus' right. He's in the place of host. John's to his right because he could lean his head back on his breast, and he does. So John's on the right. Who's on the left? Well, Jesus is going to say, the one that dips in the soft the same time I am. There's only two guys that could dip in the same bowl as Jesus at the table. John's one, which means Judas was in the place of honor. We also know where one other person is, Peter. Peter's on the other end of the table because he had heard Jesus say, hey, when you go to a feast, take the low seat, and then they'll say, you know, oh, well, you're doing it down there, come on up. So Peter takes the bottom table. He's across from them on the horseshoe because he's yelling across to John, ask him who it is, you know. Jesus never took him out of the low seat, left him right there. But anyway, so let's get through this because we got to end. He sat down with the 12, as they did eat, he said, verily I say unto you, one of you shall betray me. And they were exceeding sorrowful and began every one of them to say, Lord, is it I? And he answered and said, he that dips his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me. The Son of Man goes as it's written of him, but woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man if he had not been born. Did Judas have a choice? Yes, all along. Could he have repented? I think he could have, but I think the Lord knew that he never would. And then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? And he said, you said it. And then we see communion instituted. And if you read Luke's gospel, one thing should jump out at you. Judas is there for this. He doesn't leave until after it's over, which means the first communion Judas takes part in. Was it salvation for Judas to partake of this? No, it was not. They were eating. Jesus took the bread, blessed it, broke it, gave it to the disciples, and said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup, he gave thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink all of you, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for the many, for many, for the remission of sins. I like this. You think, well, if I get clean first, then I can partake of the body of Christ. You'd almost think you'd have to reverse the order. Drink first, the blood would cleanse you, then you can have the body. It doesn't work that way. You partake of the broken body that's broken for you, and then his blood washes you. You don't have to clean yourself up to come to Christ. He does the cleaning. And then he says this interesting thing, which I've said before is a very personal verse for me, not global application. I'm telling you my personal application. I read this verse, but I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Ephesians 5, says, don't be drunk with wine, wherein is in excess, but be filled with the Spirit. Don't, you know, the time is short. Don't be dulling yourself, blunting yourself. being less sharp. Instead, you should be filled. You should, you know, being filled with the Spirit doesn't make you stupid and drunk and all those things. It's contrasted. It makes you sharper. It should make you wiser. All of those things. The Bible is very clear. Don't be drunk. It never says never have a drink. They're drinking wine here. There was no grape juice. They're drinking wine. But I read this verse, and I'll be honest with you. I like beer. I am a fan of the hop used for beer. But I, you know, when I got saved, it's okay, I won't get drunk anymore, but I still have a beer now and again. And then one time the Lord really used this verse to speak to me, saying, when he says, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until I drink it with you, new with you in my Father's kingdom, I thought, I can wait. I can wait till Jesus hands me a beer. I'm sure it's going to be better than anything watered down I've had in the past, so I will wait. And then it says, when they sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. They finished up with a song. I would love to know what they sang. Why don't we finish up with a hymn, Bob? You got something we can sing? We'll walk out with a song. Let me pray while you figure it out. Lord, thank you so much, Father, that you would have anything to do with us at all. Lord, when we look at your sacrifice, and we will look at it next week, and think of what you endured for us so that we could be called sons and daughters of God, forgiven, so that we could be the blind who regained sight, the lame who could walk, the dead who come back to life. Lord, there's nothing we have to offer you in return that's anywhere close to what you've done for us, other than our gratitude and our love. And so, Lord, as we sing to you, we do it in Jesus' name. Amen.